Okay, hello, and welcome to Radio SGN. I am one of your hosts, Lindsay Anderson, and joining me is...
Benny Loy.
My pronouns are she, her.
And I'm she, they.
And this is our show. I guess we'll just get to the news right away. We kind of covered this a little bit last week, but we have a much more in-depth coverage of the Supreme Court's ruling in Alanis versus 303 Creative LLC, written by yours truly. So I guess we could just dive right in and kind of talk a little bit more about the nuances of this case, because it's very interesting.
Definitely, definitely.
Yeah. So when the court ruled in favor of Colorado graphic designer Lori Smith, one of the first things that really stands out with this case is that it is primarily a hypothetical. So Lori Smith does not currently has a business that discriminates against LGBTQ people. She just intends to expand her business and wants to write that she will not make wedding websites for queer couples. So she sued on the grounds that she believed the Colorado Anti-Discrimination Act would be used against her and she would be forced to pay a fine, attend classes that would educate her on why she's being discriminatory and why that's a no-no, and that she would have to take that policy down. So the court actually took this case up, even though a lot of legal professionals argue that it didn't have much standing backing it. And the reason they took it up was because it's very similar in its premise to the Masterpiece Cake Shop case from 2018. Benny, do you remember that one?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. That actually, it's same. It's in Colorado again, the same kind of anti-discrimination policies. So the court really took into account a lot of specifics when it came to 303 Creative. For one thing, they said that because she uses her own written narratives and artwork on the wedding websites, or she intends to because she hasn't done them yet.
Yeah.
Then that makes it art. That art is protected as speech under the First Amendment of the Constitution and cannot be held to the same scrutiny that other things like businesses and business practices and discrimination can be held to. So for that reason, they determined that she has the freedom to choose not to use her art for queer marriages. However, the dissent that was written by the big three, our favorite women on the Supreme Court, Sonia Sotomayor, Justice Kagan, and Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, they stated that this is kind of a historic case because it is, like we mentioned last time, the first time a protected class of citizens can be legally discriminated against. And as me and Benny kind of touched on last time, it also opens the doors for people beyond the LGBTQ community to experience legal discrimination for businesses that can use the same kind of loophole of being creative and providing creative art, from, you know, an Etsy shop to a painter that works on commissions, to say like, oh, well, I don't want to serve gay people. I don't want to serve Jewish people. I don't want to serve, you know, fill in the blank of marginalized protected class of people. They also mentioned that because her quote unquote artwork is still being monetized and profited off of, that she should have to comply to the laws of the free market that are written, such as CADA, CADA, the Colorado Anti-Discrimination Act. And so for those reasons and many more pertaining to the history of discrimination that the LGBTQ community faces, these justices dissented. And I personally agree with everything they said.
I just can't believe it's all based off of a hypothetical. And also this website business has yet to create any websites.
Yes, exactly.
It's like, okay, so we can just start businesses now where we file all the paperwork, get it rolling, but we haven't actually done any actual business yet, and then use that as grounds, hypothetically, if a group that we dislike wants to hypothetically commission us.
Yes. It's, yeah, it just, this court is very unprecedented in a lot of things they've done. Overturning Roe when it had nearly 50 years of standing was unheard of. And now taking a hypothetical into court just, and it's something that not a lot of people are talking about, you know, that it's hypothetical. But I do think that's insane.
I feel like it needs to be focused on, because if you can base rulings just on hypotheticals, I mean, you can come up with anything in your head.
Exactly.
If we're just going to base everything on hypotheticals, I mean, when they were trying to ban mifepristone, the abortion pill, they weren't basing it off of studies. Mifepristone has been used for decades and it's relatively safe. But the fact that these courts are making these rulings off of hypotheticals and they're ignoring science, they're ignoring studies, they're ignoring basic human decency, it's very alarming.
Yes, I 100% agree with that. And I don't know what we're going to see moving forward now that they have opened the doors for hypotheticals to make its way to the greatest court in the land. Because, you know, I'm a big poli-sci nerd and I listen to a lot of podcasts about the Supreme Court. And one thing that I've learned through that is, you know, a lot of times when interest groups want to change a law through the Supreme Court, they do have to wait for action to be had. They can't just move on hypotheticals. So, I mean, way back when they overturned it being illegal for gay people to have sex, you know, they had a gay couple kind of almost staged this where they knew the police were going to come and raid them for having sex. But, you know, that had to be done before they could go through with, you know, the proper filings to make it to the Supreme Court. And she really skipped over that because nobody came for her. She didn't even start this website. So, yeah, it's really crazy. And it's, I think another crazy thing that I learned after talking with Christy Mallory, who is a legal director at the Williams Institute with UCLA, is that this case is also very particular because it only will impact states that have standing anti-discriminatory laws that protect queer and trans people. That's not all 50 states. We don't have any kind of national protection against discrimination for people on the grounds of gender, sexuality, sexual orientation, things like that. So this will impact Washington state directly because we have those laws. And we saw this a couple of weeks ago with that spa case that they're looking to potentially bring up to the Supreme Court. So this definitely opens the doors for people like that to make more challenges on these anti-discriminatory laws that we have in place to protect marginalized people. So yeah, that's terrifying. What else do we have to talk about? I guess more kind of terrifying Seattle news. This is a story that we didn't personally write about with the SGN, but we did have a reader send us in a link to a Breitbart video about it. You want to take it from here, Benny?
Sure, yeah. So I guess a while ago, somebody decided to leave a lot of tire tracks on one of the pride flags that are painted on the roads in Seattle. And it was clear that it wasn't like them just, you know, being bad drivers. From security footage, it looks like they meant to deface the pride flag that was painted on the ground. Yeah, that's not great.
Yeah. Well, and the interesting part of the story, I think, comes from the way that conservative outlets have been reporting on it. Because, you know, Seattle's back in the news as being this big, bad liberal. I don't know what, this is the future liberals want, Seattle, you know.
Chaos in the streets. You can do whatever you want in Seattle because it's liberal.
Yes. And this Breitbart reporter in the video that was sent to us, he was saying, like, in Seattle, naked bike riders can do graffiti anywhere. And that's allowed because it's art. But tire tracks on the street. Oh, no. And it's like, well, first of all, you know, graffiti isn't legal in the city. And actually, we're going to have more about graffiti in just a minute in our interview with Bobby Goodwin. But yeah, like he taught me today, graffiti that contains hate speech or gang symbols is legally required to be cleaned up within 48 hours. And the rest of graffiti has a 20-day limit where the business owners or whoever owns the property that was tagged has the responsibility to clean it up, which kind of sucks. Shouldn't be on them. But that aside, we were just talking about how Washington state has seen an increase in vandalism against pride flags and other pride memorabilia this June. And kind of just going back to graffiti, that not all graffiti is bad. You know, it can be seen as art. And you were telling me about how in Eastern Washington, they have designated graffiti places, right?
Yeah. So when I lived in Spokane, you know, they have a few areas where you can graffiti there. Specifically, one of the places is under the freeway skate park, where they have, right underneath the freeway, they have a ton of really awesome skateboarding ramps and things like that. And you can graffiti there. When I was a kid, I actually got the chance to do a little bit of that because I ended up meeting a local activist who would go out of his way to cover up gang graffiti and he happened to be at the skate park that day putting up some new graffiti that was really beautiful. And he let me borrow a few cans and try it out myself. So, you know, I think that graffiti and street art can be really beautiful, can actually improve your community, can improve your connection to your community. I mean, I just wrote up an article about a new mural that was put up in Seattle for the upcoming Youth Care Constellation Center that they're putting up. So local young artists got together with artworks and designed and painted this beautiful mural. And, you know, I'm all for that. I feel like public art, it makes a city have more character and it makes the community more vibrant. Like we were saying, when it includes hate speech or different things like that, not a fan.
Yeah.
Let's only put up things that bring the community together.
Yes, absolutely agreed. So I guess now it's time for us to take a quick break. We'll be back with Bobby Goodwin, who is running for a city council position to represent District 3, and we'll talk more about graffiti and Bobby's stance on that. Yeah, stay tuned.
This is Lindsay Anderson, and I'm here with Bobby Goodwin, who is running for City Council District 3. So how are you feeling about your campaign so far?
Well, it has been quite the journey. And thanks, first of all, thanks for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to chat with you. Yeah, you know, I don't have a political background. I've been working as a public defender for the last 12 years, and really that's most of my adult life. Other than the House of Cards, I feel like that's as close to politics as I've gotten. So relative to that, it's been a fairly friendly process, I can say. But trying to run a full-time job and campaign at the same time.
That sounds like a lot. I'm not jealous of your workload at the moment. So I have a couple of questions prepared just based off of the platforms that you've mentioned or stated that you're running on. But my first question is just about your background. I noticed on your website you mentioned that you were inspired to become a public defender after seeing a mistrial in a domestic assault case. I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on that.
Sure, yeah. So as many years ago, I was working in the city of Everett at the prosecuting attorney's office. And so something that you do a lot when you're a new attorney is you'll sit second chair. And sometimes that just means occupying that second chair during the trial and really doing and saying nothing. And I did that probably 12 times. And so it was during one of those trials that it was a case where defendant was alleged to have assaulted his former partner. They had a child in common. And then also he was being prosecuted for a subsequent violation of the no contact order that had been issued, you know, based on that initial assault. And over the course of the trial, I just became convinced that he was in fact innocent of the underlying assault. To be fair, I think there's little doubt that he violated the no contact order. But the context of the violation was essentially him saying, you know, like, really, you're not going to go through with this, are you? You know, this, these lies that you've told. So it's an understandable one. You know, it's not a legal defense, but it was understandable. And there were just lots of little things that kind of added together. Sort of one particular issue that was a piece of evidence that would have been exculpatory, right? That would have really supported the defense theory. And for no apparent reason, his attorney didn't introduce that bit of evidence. I already was aware of and had heard it. It was a 911 call that he had made, and he made it prior to this particular encounter happening. He had called law enforcement saying, you know, I'm going to pick up my things from, they had broken up, but he still had things at the house. They were, you know, trying to sort of, you know, co-parent and whatnot. And he called in and said, hey, you know, my ex, she seems really agitated. I'm concerned it could be a hazardous situation. I was wondering if maybe there could be an officer that could accompany me. And the police had told him, you know what, just go, once you go on down there and just, you know, do your best to keep things calm. And if things get out of hand, then call us. You know, that went so far to demonstrate his state of mind, right? I mean, a person who has the intention or is likely to be going and, you know, to assault someone, not too often that they're going to call police ahead of time and make statements like that. And so anyhow, just that and some other things that sort of happened during the course of the trial that had convinced me that he was in fact innocent of that assault. And, you know, there's nothing that my colleague had done that was improper, right? I mean, there was a person who told the story, right? And if that story was true, that defendant had committed a crime and, you know, warranted prosecution. But, you know, we don't know, you know, when we're the prosecutors and defense attorneys, we are not the triers of fact, right? That's what the jury does. But the prosecutor, you know, is supposed to exercise their discretion and judgment and, you know, when they think a particular individual is credible or not. And those aren't easy decisions to make. So generally, they're going to round on the side, the conservative side, which is to prosecute. And I think that's probably most of the time a good decision in domestic violence in that historically, you know, these things were under-prosecuted for so long, right? But at times that pendulum can overcorrect. And, you know, I can't as one individual, right, make sure that there's a good defense attorney and a good prosecutor. It's like, I can only make sure there's going to be one competent counsel in any given trial. And I figure, you know, if there's going to be just one, it's better that it's the defense attorney if we're going to have fair outcomes.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. So from what I saw based on your platform that you're running on, I didn't see anything about domestic violence or, you know, that specific issue. Do you have any intentions to help create policy around that issue?
A good question. There hasn't been something that's been of mind in terms of the conversations I've had either with, you know, sort of neighbors about their, you know, primary causes of concern or something derivative of my experience that I would have concern. When I, you know, that's a really great question. Honestly, no one's asked me that throughout this process. If I were, I'll tell you this, probably the thing I would be most want to see is perhaps some kind of, and this is tricky because, you know, when we talk about separation of powers, you know, some of these things are things that are up to, you know, it's the judiciary, for example. In domestic violence cases, no contact orders, as I mentioned earlier, are imposed as a matter of course anytime an allegation is raised. And they are just incredibly disruptive for families. And even in cases where the allegations might be somewhat minor or even really dated, right? Because sometimes someone's getting charged for a thing from a year ago or even farther. And so all of a sudden, you know, a couple that maybe have multiple kids have been living together, and now the defendant, you know, is forbidden from returning to the house at all, from having any kind of communications, even electronic. And that's really tough, even when if the other party wants the order, that's easy. You know, there's nothing to talk about. Great. Like, it's great that's processed in place. But it's very, very common with these sorts of charges that neither party wants it. And even when an alleged victim shows up in court time and time again, asking for them to be lifted, a judge simply won't do it unless, you know, a defendant has done X number of things that the judge, you know, wants them to do, even if they're still supposed to be presumed innocent. And that's something I suppose I'd say that over the years in domestic violence context, it's ended up hurting, I think, victims as well. But I'm not sure, it's hard for me in this moment to imagine what kind of conceivable practical policy choices could be made, right, in terms of something in the city code, right, that dictates how these sorts of orders should be issued or rescinded that wouldn't run afoul of the separation of powers, right, and a judge's power to make a decision. So, but that's the things that we're thinking about.
Thank you. So now I'll just get into a couple questions about some of your policies that you're running on. The first being affordable housing. So I saw that one of your aims is to get rid of the design review process for all affordable housing projects. And I wanted to know why you believe in this.
Yeah, you know, and that's a pretty popular idea. It's something that actually the council had done temporarily during the pandemic. The design review process can be incredibly, you know, burdensome and time consuming. So it adds lots and lots of cost to projects. You know, when we have this urgent and desperate need for housing, you know, we're not nearly keeping up with the Novan. And of course, we also have this expectation that Seattle is likely to be a place where, you know, more and more climate refugees are going to come over time. And so we expect those numbers to just increase. I do think, that being said, that it's important that sort of a benefit is only being granted to projects that genuinely represent affordable housing and not just a place with, you know, two units out of 50. Right. There have been, I think, too many instances where you see those kinds of abuses taking place. And it would definitely be important to me to make sure that we weren't doing that and that we were creating the right incentives here to, you know, make it more viable, you know, financially for companies to be doing this.
I also saw that kind of on the same platform, you want to propose a vacancy tax. Could you explain a little bit what this would look like?
Yeah, you know, and this is actually also a popular idea about amongst of, I think at least half of the folks running here in District 3 would like to see this happen. And the idea here is that we want to make sure that folks aren't, you know, buying up and acquiring property and simply using them as investments, right? And, you know, waiting around and sitting on those properties while folks are sitting in the streets. And then there's a lot of nuance here in terms of how we can imagine this is done in terms of like what's the time period during which we say, like, now that amounts to a vacancy, right? The place is empty for 2 months. Is that sufficient? And so probably the devil ends up being in a lot of these details. I imagine using some sort of a metric closer to probably 6-ish months is what it would take in terms of being reasonable. But so where you have investment properties that are bought up, if they're not being put to some, you know, best use, then you're getting a different, it's like having a different tax rate then, right? In terms of your own property tax. And that in what you would do is that particular tax would be earmarked so that 100% of those resources are going towards our public housing projects, right? And we know we've had a need to find additional progressive sources for that. And so this could certainly contribute, but part of the idea of having a vacancy tax in the end isn't to collect on it, right? But it's to ensure that these things aren't being squandered in this way, right? And that the resources, the houses are being you know, put to better use. It also works a little bit in tandem with the idea that I've proposed to increase the tax on short-term rentals. Something that we've seen over the last 6-7 years in the city of Seattle is really an astronomical increase in Airbnbs throughout the city. And it's something that a bunch of neighbors that I've talked to while going door to door have brought up to me and raised concern. That's really what first brought this issue to my attention. It's not something that had been, you know, an activating issue for me in terms of the decision to run for council. And after doing some research on, you know, things that other cities and places have done, I definitely think that there's a value to making sure that we are disincentivizing folks from having short-term rentals. Because I have also spoken to people who talked about having been in buildings, you know, long-term as rentals, watched as those buildings got purchased up, right, by other, often, you know, corporate entities, and then turned into Airbnbs, these short-term rentals. I mean, there's like an entire industry out there. You could, you know, look online, Seattle short-term rentals. If you did, the first couple things would come up would be, you know, websites trying to sell you on the market for short-term rentals, right? Where, you know, they'll help you in terms of those acquisitions. And that's really problematic.
Absolutely. Thank you. So kind of transitioning away then from taxes on property owners, another thing that I've seen you stand for was wanting to prosecute more property-related crimes like theft, minor theft of like property, bicycles, hubcaps. And I was just wondering if you could elaborate a little bit about your stance on that.
Ultimately, it's about ensuring that we live in a city where there is a sense of accountability. You know, something you hear from a lot of businesses, especially in the height of the pandemic, and this was complicated, of course, because there was, you know, health reasons that we wanted to limit the populations in our jails to try to minimize the spread. And that had some unfortunate consequences, many of which were actually really destructive even for those individuals. Like as an example, I had a client who, you know, was, when he first came to me, he'd had no, you know, prior criminal history, you know, 7 months earlier. And then he showed up and he had 7 separate cases, either possession of stolen vehicle or theft of a motor vehicle. And so those are class B felonies, fairly serious. And once upon a time, you would have been booked the first time you were arrested on something like that. You might have been released at your first hearing called the arraignment, but you would have at least initially, you know, been brought into custody, you've seen a judge, and you have this certain amount of disruption that happens through that process. But because of the pandemic, right, he was being cited and released and not ever going through even that booking process. That was until the 7th time when he was eventually booked. And so now this person who would have otherwise been facing, you know, likely just this one felony, not had been in a great position for us to work to resolve his case in a way without a felony on his record, lots of different, you know, ways to achieve that, now has 7 separate cases, is now maxed off the grid, looking at a standard sentencing range of 43 to 57 months in prison, even if he was just convicted out of 4 of the 7, right? It was a really terrible outcome for him. And this particular client was struggling pretty badly with meth addiction. And so there was never that moment in time to have that kind of disruption for him from that space, for his mind to clear a bit in terms of that judgment and to process really what was at stake and the consequences for him, right? Because he didn't know. And when you have that encounter and you're just cited and released, it doesn't seem that serious, right? It doesn't feel that serious the second time, right? And so, or the third, right? And so you go from that, right, to all of a sudden, you know, crashing your car into, you know, a terrible brick wall. And so that's really unfortunate. Yeah. And so, you know, there's some of that happening, right, with a lot of businesses, with folks just walking into stores. You know, if you think about Broadway, that QFC there on Broadway and the other entrance that now is just closed down. And when you're going into the store, right, they created these sort of weird little maze barriers and sequences of things to, you know, out of desperation to try to prevent what's going on. And that's not a way for the city to be operating, right? We have to be doing better than that. And of course, some of these things are being perpetuated because of our failure to provide for, you know, our neighbors better, right? In terms of housing and so on. Tons and tons of homeless individuals don't commit crimes, right? It's not as though that's a, you know, inevitable byproduct, right? What you really end up having happen at those times is there's, I think, a small segment of that population that is way, way disproportionately engaged in this kind of behavior. And, you know, I've had just a lot of neighbors who I've talked to describe, you know, having catalytic converters cut off their cars multiple times, right? That's the worst sort of crime, right? Because for the individual who does so, they receive a relatively trivial financial benefit when it comes at an extraordinary cost for the victim. And then that's what happened for me. You know, for example, someone had, who had stolen my car, and that was about 2 years ago now. You know, it was recovered. It was recovered outside of an encampment over there off Dearborn. And, you know, ultimately, I had to give my car rekeyed. And, you know, that was $1,000. You know, and I privileged enough that I could afford that, but I'm not crushing it. Public defender salaries, when you're having to pay Seattle rents, only get you so far.
Thank you for elaborating on that. And I just wanted to ask kind of a connecting question because I saw that you're also in support of alternatives to incarceration. So how would the prosecution process look without incarceration following these crimes of like vehicle theft?
Sure. Well, one thing to note out the gates here. So when we talk about like the vehicle theft matter that I just brought up and that client. So since those are felony charges, those actually aren't charges that really the city attorney or a city council has any connection to, right? The city, the municipal court, the municipal code only pertains to misdemeanor crime, right? So anything that were a felony charge, like if someone were to steal a motor vehicle in the city of Seattle, ends up going to King County Superior Court. And so it would be a King County Council. And generally, really, we're talking about the state legislature, right, that has any change of those laws, right, the revised code of Washington. And that's where we had this kind of issue that came up most recently, right, about whether or not state code under the RCWs would be adopted into our Seattle code, which is the SMCs. And that is something which, you know, was properly before the council. It's a lot easier in some ways to make sense of, again, those deferral processes in drug court when you're dealing in superior court because of the fact that the scale is so different, right? In superior court, you don't generally measure a sentence in days, right? Sentences are measured in months, right? When we talk about a sentencing range, it's in months. And so with that, right, it's a whole other type of motivation for an individual to say, okay, I'm going to, you know, sign up to engage in an 18-month drug court program. And those programs have been incredibly successful, but those are huge, serious programs, right? And an 18-month program doesn't really make sense if, you know, what you're at risk of is like a 30-day sentence, for example, or less than that even, right, on some misdemeanor charge. So really the only, one of the kind of main times that you see significant deferral programming in misdemeanor land is when we're talking about DUI offenses. And that's because DUI offenses are the only misdemeanor charges that by statute have their own special sentencing ranges. Well, actually, that's a misstatement with one other exception for a particular driving offense, but that sort of elevates as they do with subsequent charges. This connects with what does a community court look like? What might it have looked like? What was going wrong? And what could, you know, what could a better and more effective alternative court do right? Yeah, I mean, I'd love to touch more on that. But again, it's a little ancillary now. I feel like I'm getting a bit afield here from your question.
We can just move on to, here's a couple more questions about a part of your platform that is unique compared to other candidates running for District 3, and that is your Make Seattle Sexy Again stance. Why do you think you are the only candidate that is running on a platform that includes cleaning graffiti from the city?
I would say that my platform, it's a large part, right, of my platform. And I think it matters more to me, matters more to some people than others, right? I mean, to be honest with you, there's many times that I'm going, you know, door to door. And when the graffiti issue comes up, I have neighbors tell me, I don't care about that. It's not important. It's not important to me at all. You know, I've heard that from plenty of people. And so I understand certainly for those individuals, the human suffering is of course their primary, you know, concern, right? When we're talking about homelessness, the addiction issue, the behavioral health crisis, by all means, if I could choose to just solve one of those things, I assure you it would not be, you know, graffiti, in that I also care more about the human suffering, or else I wouldn't be doing what I do. And I've done this for 12 years. It's not easy work for that reason, especially again, trying to find this balance with running some kind of a campaign while also making sure that, you know, I'm doing right by my clients has been quite a challenge. But along the way, in terms of even leading me to the decision to run, is I've been probably a month or so after the Floyd protests, actively myself just involved as a just kind of vigilante volunteer, as it were, in the community, going out and cleaning up graffiti. And that's something that I do often, something that I've committed also to, you know, should I be elected onto the city council, commitment to spending 20 hours, you know, a month, spending time cleaning the streets, right? And cleaning graffiti. You know, that's a lot of time, right? It's 240 hours in a year. And I tried to get as close as I could to that many hours each month thus far. That's a lot of what I've done in terms of my campaigning. So I have my little cart with my sign, and I go out, I pick up trash, I clean up graffiti. And I'm trying to live up to and showcase through my actions, right, what that looks like. You know, we can inspire and motivate more folks to do that, to put in that effort. It's not something that has to be a matter of, you know, a big cost to the city, right? You know, the improvement is material. I mean, I've had a lot of folks I've talked to about it that I've reached out and said, hey, you know what, take my number, call me the next time you're doing something, right? I want to join you. So I think it's in that, right? I think it's the way in which I've integrated it into my campaigning process itself, and also into my commitment of what and in what way I would like to serve this city if given the chance.
Thank you. And I just have one more question for you. And I know we're running out of time, so if you could maybe keep your answer to about 2 minutes. I know it's asking a lot. But I just wondered if you could elaborate on the Capitol Hill Superblock, which you intend to help create.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, anytime we're talking about the pedestrianization of the neighborhood, I think that, you know, we're talking about making the place safer. We're talking about making a place more appealing, attractive to visit. Whenever I can remember the first time going to block party, probably 10 years ago or so, seeing Frightened Rabbit, my favorite bands. And there was something just that's so fun about walking through those streets that you were so accustomed to, just, you know, being confined to this little bit of sidewalk with this busy traffic around you, and being taken over by the pedestrian. You know, I mean, most of the favorite sort of places, again, in Europe, we think about highlighted destinations to go, they all have those sorts of places and spaces. And I just love to see that. I mean, I'd love to see us further pedestrianize the end of Broadway too, right? And we think about from that light rail station to the end, it's not nice right now, unfortunately. The graffiti, the trash, the sidewalks are falling apart. You know, expanding those sidewalks, making it feel safer, could make that a great destination for folks who are, you know, when the light rail connects to the east and you're on your way to the game, you're leaving the game, you know, to stop and, you know, do some bar hopping, check out some great restaurants down there, Rob Mai Tai, favorite spot. So yeah, you know, I think that's just kind of my general thinking and hope. A few of us want to see that super block happen. So hopefully, whether it's me or another, we can make that change.
Nice. Super cool. Thank you for elaborating that and answering all my questions. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we wrap up?
One of the things at this point, right, that's differentiating my campaign from the others is that I was the only person who would have voted with the minority to empower the city attorney to prosecute for possession. And I think this is incredibly controversial. There are a lot of people really, really passionate about this issue and conceive of that decision as one as a racist one and a, you know, return to the war on drugs. And I understand that thinking, but ultimately, I think that is mistaken. There's a few important, really significant distinctions. For one, we're talking about misdemeanor offense. For two, it's not to say that this means either that I would want to see or that the SPD would intend to be arresting, rounding up and arresting each person who's possessing or using into jail. There's not the resources. There's not that. That's not practical. Even 5 years ago when it was a felony, SPD wasn't doing that, right? They would confiscate and destroy controlled substances on a person that was in and otherwise detained for, you know, relatively benign contact. And maybe you end up, you know, still charged with a theft third or something, right? But you're not also getting charged with a controlled substance. But it's this other tool, it's this opportunity. It helps with the disruption of the open air drug markets. It's hard if what you have to do is demonstrate evidence of intent to distribute with, you know, the volume of drugs or scales and these other things, it can be really hard from afar for, you know, for officers to be able to make those kinds of probable cause determinations to justify that contact. You know, so it really is, I think, in the end, about trying to see and create better opportunities for disruption. I want to see folks in treatment whenever we can, right? Always that's the preference. We don't have the beds. We don't have the providers. Those are longer term solutions, making those happen. In the short term, Seattle, we have some of the worst overdose rates in the country, right? By the time the first one of those behavioral clinics is going to open from our last little levee there, right? There's going to be over 1,000 people will die of overdose at this rate. That's totally unacceptable, right? We need to do better. We can't just keep walking past, you know, our neighbors when you see them suffering, see them unconscious. So there's more nuance here, right? So I just encourage folks to take that into consideration. I'm happy to talk to anybody about it. If they want to follow up with me, email me, Goodman for Seattle. Get back to everybody who does. And again, hey, thank you so much for giving me this platform, this opportunity to speak with you.
Thank you so much. This has been a great interview, and I have enjoyed getting to know more about your campaign. So thank you for coming on.
And we're back.
We're back.
That was a fun interview.
You did a great job, Lindsay.
Thank you, Benny. Thank you so much. Listeners at home, Benny has not heard that interview yet. They just have blind faith in me, and we love that.
I've got your back. I know that whatever you're doing a great job.
Oh, thank you. It means a lot. We're very supportive on this podcast. And so now I guess we're just going to do something fun for the rest of this episode. So please join us as we do some dramatic readings of Seattle Craigslist postings.
All right.
So this post comes from Anthony Best. It was posted on June 29th at 1801, 2023. I want to get married and have a child or two. It's all caps, so that's why he's yelling. I want to get married and have a child or two. You can find my profile here. There has been a link to his Instagram profile. I will not read that out loud, but look him up if you want to get married and have a child or two. He's very passionate about that.
This one might be a little bit saucy, not in the words, but like in the possible context to this. So, strict teacher, I'll wait patiently for you. It was so nice to speak with you, and though I be patient, I can't wait until the next. Have a lovely evening.
I love that.
Ooh, somebody's having a good time with their night school.
Yes. This is on July 3rd from GGG. The title is Man Wants Chinese Lady, 40 to 45, friendship/travel. Want to travel to China's large cities and other countries. Very friendly and fun-loving person, the friendship could lead to more or stay as friends. How, I ask, can you lose?
Oh, no. So this one seems like it might be a bit cute. It's called, Oh, fast food worker, .. I love what you do and how you do it. The elegance and grace of working in a crowded and hot area deserves so much more than a thank you and platitudes of have a nice day. I salute you. Honestly, that's like, workers unite.
Yeah, absolutely. We stand for that here.
Beautiful woman in red Chevy mobile gas. Beautiful woman driving the red Chevy, maybe Tahoe or Suburban. Back window had a decal saying rock and roll. I believe, in quotation marks, I was on the phone. I wanted to get out and say hi before you left the store. You were in and out so fast. Winky face. Definitely would like to have gotten your number and grab a beverage with you. So I know it's you. Tell me the color of your shirt and or more about your the decal.
The color of your shirt? Code for something?
You can just send a picture if you want, and I will send you one back.
No.
So many red flags.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, there's probably a reason why she was in and out of the store so fast. Like, I don't want to be mean about your possible meet cute, but I'm just trying. I immediately put myself in like the perspective of these people, and I'm just like, yeah, I'd be running.
This one starts with, my name is Kara Malone. I am looking for a guy that hit on me in Ireland and Italy and other places. I was wondering if he wants to date me. He replied with a handsome picture of him. I was wondering if he wanted to date me. I hope he replies soon. I thought he is very good looking and did want to dance. You should give me your number. Mine is, and then the number, but we should not say that on the air. Hopefully we can connect and move on from there. She then posted again. I can't stop thinking about you a lot. all the time, so please provide me some information about you. I only wasn't the guy hitting on me to reply back, thanks. Unless you know his number or something. From I think everything he does is perfect. From Kara Malone. We have another one from Kara Malone. I can't remember his name. I think he said it was John. I can't remember. He hit on me at Blackpool when I was 14. That should declare it. Then we've got, we also hung out in Italy with my sister on the bus. To which someone responded, no one cares.
No.
She said. Then why did he respond with a picture 3 years ago? He must care. Then somebody said, Kara Malone, it was 3 years ago. So somebody must care, she said. And then we've got the final installment. Oh, not the final installment. I'm so sorry. He is from Ireland. I don't know his first name. Please come back again. Pictures will do well.
Oh, Kara, I hope you find this person.
Yes, the final response from Kara Malone goes, hi, he hit on me in Ireland, also Prague. Responded back 3 years ago. Reply to me on Craigslist. I have a Facebook page. Kara Malone, Minneapolis. I am wearing a skirt. Oh, Kara. I also have one with my aunt. If you can respond to me, that would be great. Okay, thanks. I hope everything is going well for you.
Kara is so down bad for, what is his name, John?
John? His name might be John. She can't remember because she met him when she was 14. I hope you find him, Kara Malone.
Yeah. Here's one. 4th of July party. I spotted you at an unpatriotic 4th of July party. Full of friends who purportedly hate America. Your blue eyes were really far apart. Made you look innocent as Bambi. Jane Doe, be my dear.
Oh, that's smooth, though.
Not exactly. The whole, like, your blue eyes were really far. I don't know if that's a compliment. Made you look as innocent as Bambi. That, hopefully that's just, like, a reference to a conversation they had or something like that. Not just, like, a really out there remark.
Yikes. I'm trying to find anything else that doesn't use the word females directly. There's a lot that do.
Oh, no. Okay, this one's ominous.
Oh, read your ominous one.
Hot black cutoffs, and all it says is, I know you, period. Granddaughter of a friend, period. I just have a feeling, period. Just ask? Question mark?
Interesting.
I'm a little scared.
Yeah.
Alrighty.
This is interesting, though. I'm falling into an internet hole over here.
Yeah. I used to do this way back in the day when I was really bored. Locked eyes at Costco. I was walking out of Costco, period. You and your boyfriend were walking in, period. And we locked eyes.
Oh. Costco misconnection. Finding love in the cheese aisle.
They're taken. Respect that they're in a relationship. All this because they locked eyes in the cheese section at Costco.
Oh, God.
So that Costco one, like, this is why I have a fear of locking eyes with strangers in public. Because
they might think you're coming on to them.
Yes. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. It's just like, I'm currently dissociating. While, like, vaguely looking in the, you know, at the giant jugs of milk that they have at Costco where you can only buy two at a time and they're, like, more than a gallon. Don't buy milk at Costco if you have a normal life and you don't consume a lot of milk and you have a small fridge. But I am terrified of locking eyes with people now.
Absolutely. People are, like, so... I don't know. It's like the meat cute is dead. You know, you're not going to find a date at Costco. If you are that down bad, get Tinder, get Grindr.
Yeah.
Hinge. There are so many
just
different.
Just go with the old-fashioned way of downloading Grindr. Like,
yeah. Or go to a bar. No. But like, Costco is for married Christian women on a Sunday afternoon. With
honestly.
Their, like, 10 kids.
Honestly, like, they're trying to run their own little, like, cafe, and they're picking up all the ingredients. Like, don't bother this girl boss who's using their boyfriend as a strongman to carry all the groceries into the car.
Thank you. That's been our show. I'm Lindsay Anderson.
And I'm Benny.
And, yeah, thanks for listening. Let us know if you see any weird misconnections on Craigslist. And, I don't know, keep being gay. Have a great week.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Radio SGN is hosted by Benny Loy and Lindsay Anderson. and edited by Daniel Lindsley. The music for the show is provided by TRG Banks and Jesse Spillane, or was provided for free by Anchor. Thank you so much for listening. Check us out on sgn.org. This podcast is part of the Seattle Gay News Podcasting Network.